continuing efforts to make the coastline livable again for people and wildlife. After the Exxon oil spill last March, Exxon has hired thousands of workers for the cleanup, and a small group of volunteers has been working away too, convinced that their efforts are more thorough than what the oil company is doing. Joe Gallagher of Alaska Public Radio has a report.
At first glance, Mars Cove looks like a piece of pristine wilderness. It's hard to see any oil in the water, and from the air, the beach looks clean. That perception disappears immediately once you set foot on the ground. There are five small beaches in the cove, and they're all covered with oil. The mucky brown substance clings to everything. It covers large rocks, tiny pine needles, and is embedded in the cliffs that surround the beach. The 15 volunteers work with the tides. When it's out, they hit the beach and begin systematically doing the work. With small hand trawls and brushes, the volunteers scrape away at the oil. It's slow work, and progress is defined in square feet, not miles. But the attitude is positive. Keena Hollett came from Atlanta to help out on the oil spill. Sitting on a beach in Mars Cove in a light but cold rain, she was busy scraping away at the oil-covered rocks.
This is filth. I mean, it's got to be cleaned. And oil, it's amazing. It's really difficult to get it off, and it's not going to hose away, and you can't just let nature try to fight it itself. We need to come and give it a hand and clean it really rock by rock. It's so much worse than I ever thought it would be.
The volunteers are using a different strategy than Exxon has employed over the summer. Rather than bag up the contaminated material and ship it out to dump sites, they plan to run the rocks through a gravel washing machine and then put the rocks back on the beach. What constitutes a clean beach is being debated right now by Exxon, the Coast Guard, and the state. Volunteer organizer Ben Levine says the beach will never be restored to its original condition. The goal of the volunteer group is to clean it to a point where people can enjoy the beach without being worried about oil.
This is a state park where we are. You know, people can come in here and kayak or hike, and if you want to sit down on the beach and have your picnic lunch off of your kayak, you want to be able to sit there and not be worried about really what you're sitting in. Or if a bird lands on it, their feet don't get oiled or the feathers. An otter can drag themselves up on the beach and go into the forest, you know, land otter. Restore it to an acceptable level where you're not risking re-oiling, and life can continue more or less as normal.
Attaining that goal is going to take a lot of hard work. The volunteers recently received the go-ahead from the Coast Guard to use the gravel washing machine, and it's hoped that will speed up the cleaning process, but a lot of work will still have to be done by hand. Eric Larson of Anchorage was working on a cliff that bordered Mars Cove. The oil had splashed up into the cracks of the rock wall, and he was busy trying to scrape it out.
You just sort of think of the magnitude of this thing, that I'm looking at one square foot here, scraping off moose, and there are 700 miles of this stuff. The immensity of it and the severity of it just sort of soaked into me, and just had to think about it for a while. It was very sad.
The Exxon crews are scheduled to begin shutting down cleanup operations. Company officials are sticking to plans to be off the beach by September 15th. The volunteers say they will remain in Mars Cove past September and stay as long as weather permits and work can be done. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Gallagher in Homer, Alaska.
This week in Prince William Sound and along the Alaska Gulf Coast, Exxon is laying off the workers it hired to clean up the nation's worst oil spill. The company says it's shutting down operations for safety reasons before the onset of winter weather, which often brings high winds. Exxon spokespeople have said that all of the 1,000 or more miles of coastline damaged by oil have been cleaned, treated, or environmentally stabilized. But the state of Alaska is challenging those assertions and will issue a winter oil spill plan of its own on Friday. Most of the areas in dispute are very remote, like the rocky eastern coast of the Kenai Peninsula and its national park, accessible only by boat or float plane. Corey Flintoff of Alaska Public Radio reports from the nearby fishing town of Seward.
Black Bay is the finger's end of a long inlet in the Kenai Fjords National Park. It's a long way from Prince William Sound, where the Exxon Valdez spilled its oil, but the black crude found its way here. It's a long way from the fishing town of Seward, where an Exxon contractor hired cleanup crews to wash its rocks and pick up oily debris. The crews are gone now, and from a skiff offshore, the beach looks almost clean. It's what park ranger Joe Meehan calls a cobble beach, a loose jumble of granite rocks and boulders. He pulls the skiff ashore and clambers out to turn the salt and pepper stone and show the black and brown scum that clings to the undersides and glistens in the spaces below.
A lot of this oil has gone down in between the rocks, and the crews have said they've washed cobble beaches like this before. Oil goes down, gets stuck, it doesn't come out where it can be absorbed, and then the next high tide will just bring the oil right back up to the surface and either put it back on top or float it away where it's going to be a hazard to the wildlife in the area and possibly oil more beaches down the line.
Ranger Joe Meehan says this is a particularly tough beach to clean, but if it's left like this, it'll go on killing seabirds and the scavengers, including bears that feed on them. In its way, Kenai Fjords is one of the most spectacular parks in the national system. Its finger-like inlets fold more than 400 miles of shoreline into a coast that's barely 70 miles long. When the oil from the Exxon Valdez began to escape from Prince William Sound, the national park lay right in its path. Park officials aren't sure just how much of their coastline is fouled. Much of it is so rocky, with surf so violent, no boat or even helicopter can get close enough to look. Even so, a lot of the oil got past the headlands and deep into the sheltered waters, where it lodged on beaches like the one at the head of Black Bay. Cleanup crews have been over many parts of the oiled beaches, but often with a treatment that consists of little more than picking up tar balls and oily flotsam and leaving the soaked-in oil alone.
I think it's important to note that a treated beach does not mean thoroughly treated, well-treated, or clean.
Park biologist Russ Kuczynski.
So when you hear that they've treated the beach, realize that the oil they got from the beach could be anywhere from 1% to 100% of the oil. It did not address the real impact on the beach, and it's those that it's gross contaminant is what the eagles have gotten gooed up with. And other animals, including otter and both sea otter and land otter. You can go to the beach and find as much oil as it was ever there, but again, it's a treated beach. And you know, from our perspective, that things of that nature are a dismal failure.
The park superintendent at Kenai Fjords worries that things aren't going to get any better this winter, especially if storms start washing the oil from damaged beaches and recontaminating others. Ann Castellina has been reviewing Exxon's winter spill plan.
We're not in it. They're going to put a couple of 150-foot skimmers and a couple in Valdez, and they're going to put one in Homer and one in Kodiak, and those are supposed to protect all four of the zones that are affected or will continue to be affected by the oil. Do you know how hard it's going to be or how long it's going to take to get a boat from Homer and around Gore Point up here if there's a threat of oil? 20 hours at minimum, if you can get a boat around Gore Point. The closest boat to us that's going to be able to offer any assistance is going to be in Homer. And yet, where is the oil coming out of Prince William Sound, should it continue to flush out this winter, going to hit first? Seward. We're the first in line.
The town of Seward itself escaped direct oiling, but it fell right in the path of the oil spill business boom, swelling as a headquarters for cleanup crews, wildlife rescue efforts, contract boats, and planes. Ann Castellina thinks it'll take a long time before the community recovers, both psychologically and financially, from an economy turned upside down.
Easy money, quick money, lots of money. Businesses, local businesses that have floundered, some have gone out of business because all their workers left to go work on oil spill work. Daycare centers that have closed because they could not get people to come and work for them as assistants, and so could not meet state regulations for numbers of people. That has an amazing effect. Just one little daycare center closing, that's 30 families who have no place for their kids. You know, these kinds of psychological effects are going to be felt by this community and every community affected by any kind of a disaster. And it's going to persist a lot. It's going to persist long after September 15th or whatever date it is that Exxon walks out and turns the lights out.
The state of Alaska is expected to unveil an independent winter plan on September 15th, including a scaled-down cleaning effort and a mental health outreach program for people in the affected communities. For National Public Radio, I'm Corey Flintoff in Seward, Alaska.
Tomorrow, Exxon will officially end its summer cleanup of the oil spill in Prince William Sound, Alaska. It's been nearly 6 months since the Exxon Valdez ran aground and spilled 11 million gallons of oil there. Exxon says it has stabilized the beaches and has called for a night of celebration. State officials in Alaska are less sanguine, and they're trying to figure out who will pick up where Exxon has left off. Steve Cooper is Alaska's governor.
Exxon has tried very hard, I think. There's no question about the fact that they've had a lot of manpower on the beaches that have attempted to do what's necessary to remove the oil. The oil's still there, and there is a certain amount of work that can and should be done during the winter, and we do expect Exxon to resume their work in the spring. So while there has been a substantial amount of work done, its effectiveness is in question at the moment.
You've said that there'll be some winter cleanup crews recruited until the spring when Exxon comes back. Have you been told that Exxon will come back and resume the cleanup?
Well, we haven't got any official pronouncements from Exxon yet. I expect to be meeting with the chairman of Exxon and expect to address that subject. In addition, the pronouncements coming out of Washington indicate pretty clearly that Exxon realizes that it has some responsibility beyond tomorrow.
But so far, you have not been told by Exxon that they'll be coming back.
No, I have not.
You have been recruiting winter cleanup crews.
Well, the state has been recruiting people from local communities who can do relatively small community beach cleanup programs during the winter.
Who's paying for that?
Well, initially the state will pay for it. We will add that to the bill, so to speak, that we send to Exxon, and whether it has to be litigated later on remains to be seen. We think that's a secondary issue. The main thing that we think we need to do is to put into place a reasonable program in the winter, which would include the community beach cleanup program, a program that allows us to protect the hatcheries, particularly the ones at Kodiak Island and in Prince William Sound. We need to track the movements of the oil and make sure that we know where it is. We know its composition will change over the winter. We just are not sure of how. And we also want to do some tests and some research and development on techniques so that when we go to battle with the oil again, when the weather clears in the spring, that we'll know what we're doing. In addition, we want to help the small communities that have been hard hit by the oil spill to cope with a pretty tough winter. There's been a lot of disruption in family life and in the normal routine in these smaller communities, and we want to help them through that.
Well, while there's been a disruption, there's also been a huge infusion of cash, as I understand it, into the state, much of it to compensate for lost catches, but a lot of it also to employ people to take part in the cleanup. What is the effect going to be in the winter when that flow of money from the cleanup effort is cut off?
Well, we think that there will be a certain amount of social disruption. There's going to be some heavy drinking, some family violence, that sort of thing. The thing that comes usually when you have a disruptive event like the one that happened, we think that's a legitimate thing for the state to take on, and we're going to do that. That means the communities will need extra help, perhaps some mental health counselors, extra law enforcement people, whatever the communities believe that they need, that's what we're going to listen for and make sure that they can get through this winter with a minimum of extra fuss.
There are similarities, it seems, between an old plan of with Senator Aiken of Vermont during the Vietnam War, you might recall, who said we should declare victory and leave. Has Exxon declared victory and decided to leave?
It isn't enough to declare victory and leave the field, obviously. We don't know what the condition of the oil will be in April or so, but we have to be ready to do what's possible.
Well, Governor Steve Cooper of Alaska, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Governor spoke with us from Juneau.
In Alaska, Governor Steve Cooper proclaimed yesterday Oil Spill Workers Appreciation Day, and he substantiated the symbolic gesture with the promise to the people of Valdez. He said the state would devote $21 million over the coming winter to help the city cope with the economic and emotional damage resulting from the oil spill from the Exxon Valdez 6 months ago, money Governor Cooper hopes will be reimbursed by Exxon. At his news conference yesterday, the governor also announced the formation of a strike team to help deal with the residual effects of the disaster.
There has already been a great increase in violence, in domestic disputes, and in the kinds of problems that lend themselves to state services that we already have available. We think the communities are entitled to some extra attention over the winter, and we're going to provide that attention.
The enormous influx of workers into the town of Valdez and Exxon's current attempt to demobilize those workers is forcing officials to confront new problems in what was once a stable community. Sue Rapley reports from member station KCHU.
In mid-August, Exxon had a total workforce of 11,000 people, but that number has dwindled rapidly in the past month. Remembering what it was like when prospective workers swarmed into the city and then waited to be hired, residents are concerned that they will be inundated with the unemployed. More than 3,000 workers have been decommissioned just in the past week. 400 came off the beaches yesterday. Exxon's logistics manager, Don Carpenter, says the cleanup workers will not be visible in Valdez because the workers move right through town and go home.
Although there are a significant number of people from Valdez throughout the entire Alaska, there have been people from each community. And as they come in to shore, our plan is, and their buses available, that they're taken back to their communities immediately. So as they've come in, they've left for home.
Looking around the streets of Valdez, it's not readily apparent that demobilization is happening. But if you stroll into the Pipeline Club at night, you find a different story.
When did you get decommissioned?
It's been over a month ago.
Why are you staying here instead of going home to your home?
Because I can make some money here.
Think they'll hire you back on?
I'm pretty sure they will.
Over the summer, the crime rate in Valdez has tripled previous year's records. Now, local police have issued a security warning because of another increase of thefts. Local resident Donna Waller says she had her truck stolen.
It just wasn't there. I live across from where the boats come in, and somebody had taken the vehicle.
Where'd you find it?
Out at the airport.
The oil company's winter plan calls for only 250 local people in Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska to be on call for emergency response to migrating oil sheens. VECO, the non-union contractor which has employed most of the workers, says only a few workers will be needed for transition to winter. Exxon's winter plan calls for 380 Exxon and contract personnel to be relocated to Anchorage offices. About 25% of those are gone now, with the rest due to move in the next 10 days. Federal agency personnel will pull out about the same time, but state agencies are staying here for the winter. It's hard to guess when demobilization will be complete for Valdez. Many people and vessels are determined to wait out the winter here, so they'll be on scene first thing in the spring. Most residents were looking forward to September 15th and the end of the cleanup, just to get their town back. But nobody knows if that will ever happen. Reporting for National Public Radio, I'm Sue Rapley in Valdez, Alaska.
When the Exxon Valdez ran aground last March, it not only fouled the shorelines of Prince William Sound, but the public image of huge American oil companies. That damage may spread all the way to Congress, where the oil industry is seeking approval to begin oil and gas exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Lisa Speer is a senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental research organization that is opposed to that exploration. Ms. Speer, let me ask, has the spill from the Exxon Valdez changed the kind of reception you've been receiving?
Absolutely. I think the images of oiled birds and dead otters and soiled beaches raised an enormous public outcry, and that public outcry was translated into tremendous pressure on Congress to act in some way to help out this situation. I think the two most important impacts have been with respect to legislation on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and on legislation to protect other sensitive areas offshore the nation's coasts around the country.
Mm-hmm.
The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is an area in Alaska that is subject to intense pressure from the oil industry. It is prized by conservationists for its wilderness and wildlife values, and the oil industry has wanted to get in there for quite a long time.
Let me explain. At the same time, the supply of oil from the northern slope is, of course, being depleted, and some projections say that it's going to begin to dry up in a couple of years. Now, that represents about 25% of the domestic oil production of this country. So can the argument not be made that it's not just the big oil companies that have an interest in perhaps developing oil resources in that refuge, but as a nation we have some interest in increasing the domestic supply of oil?
The U.S. Department of the Interior estimates that there are about 200 days worth of oil within the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge at current U.S. consumption rates. So this refuge is not the answer to the nation's energy future.
Well, let me ask you about specifically some other areas that are said to be under some interest by development, by development interest in the oil companies. There are parts of California, Florida, New Jersey, even Cape Cod. How do you meet the argument that if, because of legislative action, in part maybe inspired by public outrage and concern over what we saw occur at Prince William Sound, if that locks off development in more populated areas like the coasts of California or Cape Cod or Florida, and if, on the other hand, you're going to have a more successful lobbying effort to prevent that kind of development from occurring in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, we're going to handcuff ourselves and prevent this nation from developing domestic oil resources, which are going to become more and more necessary as we enter the 1990s.
Well, I guess I would dispute the premise of that question, which is that oil is the only answer. We believe that there are alternatives. For example, by simply increasing the fuel economy standards for automobiles by a few more miles per gallon, we could save more oil than lies in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and in all of the areas that have been protected this year by congressional legislation. And yet, we have not seen the kind of leadership required to press forward with those alternatives.
Well, let me state the obvious. The kind of economies that as responsible citizens we can make in our use of oil that will prevent us from depleting oil resources so quickly don't, on the other hand, always create jobs. And as you know, 80% of the state of Alaska's revenues are, in fact, derived from the supply of oil. The interest that some states have in developing offshore oil sites is also tied to the fact that it's a form of economic development. It creates jobs, it creates capital. Conservation efforts don't always do that.
First of all, oil definitely does generate jobs, but so does coastal tourism and recreation, particularly in places like the Florida Keys, the New Jersey coast, the Northern California coast. The economies of those regions depend on a pristine coastal environment. Massive industrial development will interfere with that and will destroy the economic base that is presently in those areas. So it will be a trade-off. Secondly, in Alaska, there are over 1,100 miles of coastline along the north coast of Alaska. All of that coastline is available to the oil industry except for the 100-mile stretch that is contained within the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The oil industry recently announced a major new field, a find, off Point McIntyre. They are drilling in the Beaufort Sea off the north coast of Alaska. They have many, many opportunities. There is tremendous amounts of oil, most likely, in those areas. We think one stretch should be saved for wildlife, and that's the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Thank you, Lisa Spear, senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
The hundreds of fishermen hurt by the Exxon spill aren't as patient as Mother Nature. Most are still waiting for the financial compensation promised by the oil company. And while the cleanup effort has ended, the claims process is expected to continue throughout the winter in 7 Alaskan offices. Exxon has also set up a claims operation in Seattle for Washington State fishermen. As Carol Levinson reports, that office is expected to get very busy as fishermen return home after a frustrating season.
I talked to Phil, and I guess the only thing that we're looking for is the letter of confirmation from Exxon, a note from the teacher to let me work on the claims files.
37-year-old Floyd Hutchins lives in Bellingham, Washington, but has spent the last 20 years fishing in Alaska's Prince William Sound. This year, however, he spent more time fishing for receipts and claim forms than for coho and Chinook salmon. The claims process is complicated, so Hutchins and other fishermen come to the recently established Fisherman Claims Office in Seattle for assistance. Here, in a setup financed by Exxon, fishermen help other fishermen wade through the cumbersome forms so they don't have to figure out the legal jargon by themselves, and they help them deal with the Exxon bureaucrats to get their claims processed. Hutchins, who, after the oil spill, started carrying a bottle of Tylenol in his briefcase, says the procedure is one big headache.
Fishing is noted for its instability and not knowing what's going to happen from year to year, but generally we don't have to deal with large corporations and lawyers and accountants to try to get a annual income. Usually what we have to do is fight Mother Nature and it's our own abilities. This year, that's all been disrupted.
Before fishermen can be paid by Exxon, many of their claims have to be authorized by the company's office in Anchorage. Seattle adjuster Bonnie Dawson is worried that the time it takes Exxon to pay their fishermen just a portion of their claims is time enough for the fishermen to grow impatient.
They're really starting to get angry because that's money that could be, that they're used to having in their bank, collecting interest. It's part of their business, you know, portfolio. And it's not being paid to them, and they were really starting to see the delay. And something's going to have to shift here, or the resentment that's already incurred over this is going to just explode as they're waiting and waiting for their own individual claims to be processed, as well as their crew members.
Exxon says it will hire more adjusters if necessary. Dawson says that would be a good idea because a process that only recently took 3 hours to accomplish now takes a couple of days. Floyd Hutchins has received 85% of his claims so far, or about $53,000. That's after he paid his four crew members and some of his other expenses. He says it's about one-tenth of what he would have made fishing this season. Exxon pays the claims as long as the fisherman has made, quote, a good-faith effort to fish in his fishery, assuming it's open.
And that's a particularly sensitive subject with us.
Seattle-based fisherman Phil McCrudden now runs the local fisherman claims office.
I think it rubs a lot of people the wrong way that they're being asked to go through some set of gyrations to fulfill Exxon's, you know, thing that they were in good faith. You know, there wasn't much good faith when it came to taking care of the tanker operations or making sure that there wasn't an alcoholic driving a ship. And suddenly they're asking the people who are damaged to meet their criteria. And I think that's probably one of the sorest points in this whole system.
But Dick Harvin, claims manager in Anchorage for the Exxon oil spill, defends the mandatory procedure.
And the reason we're doing that is because we have, under our interim claims guidelines, salmon claims guidelines, we have essentially guaranteed the fishermen their historical share of the preseason fish and game harvest forecast. We're essentially guaranteeing to make up the difference, so we need for people to fish as much as they can when their particular fishery is open. So we are requiring a good faith effort. I don't think that's working a particular hardship on any class of permit holders at all.
For the more than 600 Washington fishermen who fish in Alaska, the requirement is particularly burdensome. Many of them also fish in nearby Puget Sound, but decided against it this year so they could go to Alaska if their fishery opened up. And for those who were able to do both, there's a catch-22. Their catch in Puget Sound is deducted from their Exxon claim. On top of that, fishermen complain that the money they receive from Exxon goes right to the bank to pay off debts. Phil McCrudden says that's forced some fishermen to shelve well-laid plans.
We've had three different guys who've had to delay going to college because they didn't have any money.
Exxon's Dick Harvin says final payments should be made to those fishermen who have filed claims by the middle of next month. On the one hand, Phil McCrudden says that's unrealistic, that Exxon scrutinizes every penny of every claim, slowing down the entire process. On the other hand, he says there's not much anyone outside of Exxon can do about it.
Bottom line is, from every fisherman that I meet, is, hey, they spilled the oil. Why am I sitting in line answering their questions? You know, how dare they be niggling and diming me over $2,000 or $3,000? But the point is, it's their money, and we just have to be patient.
McCrudden says the fishermen's claims range from $30,000 to $300,000 apiece. Of course, they don't include any of the other damages fishermen claim they have suffered from the Exxon oil spill, but that's material for the fishermen's class action lawsuit, a battle now being prepared to be fought in court. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
Nearly 6 months after the oil tanker, the Exxon Valdez, ran aground in Prince William Sound, causing the biggest oil spill in American history, the Exxon Corporation has ended its cleanup operation, at least for the winter. Since March, the company has spent well over $1 billion on the work and employed more than 12,000 people. But in the end, Exxon recovered only 20% of the oil spilled. And while that's impressive by industry standards, it means that 8 million gallons of crude remains in the area to foul shorelines and beaches and damage fish and wildlife. NPR's Richard Harris reports, despite new cleanup techniques, little can be done to repair the damage once the oil is spilled.
Cleanup crews can do the most to contain an oil spill when the oil is still on the water. As long as the water is calm, booms can trap the oil and skimmers can vacuum it up. But once oil washes ashore, cleanup becomes a miserable job. And when it washes onto a rocky shore like Alaska's Prince William Sound, the task is harder still. So given this pessimistic expectation, even Exxon's sharpest critics say that the oil company did what it could with existing cleanup technologies. One of those critics is National Wildlife Federation President Jay Hare.
I don't think Exxon can be faulted for the amount of effort that they did once the disaster was already in place. I think the fault occurs much before that, and that is their simple failure and the failure of the oil industry in general to have done the necessary research and the development of the necessary technology to deal with an oil spill of this magnitude.
The technology at hand for cleaning rocky beaches is so primitive, Exxon was more or less practicing state-of-the-art by sending people out with cloths to wipe off the rocks one by one. Later, cleanup crews turned to high-pressure hoses to wash the oil back into the sound toward waiting oil skimmers. And as the oil got thicker and thicker, crews started spraying hot water to knock the black sludge off the rocks. But biologists like Sharon Christofferson from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration knew none of that would really clean up the oil.
I think it was realized from the very beginning, from all the experience that we've had with oil spills, that historically you just don't recover very much of the oil that is spilled. That has never stopped anybody from attempting to recover whatever they can. Every gallon that you do take out is one less gallon that's going to go into the sound ecology.
Christofferson is at the Emergency Response Center in the port of Valdez. She says the question among scientists there was when to stop. At a certain point, the efforts to clean up can actually do the environment more harm than good, and scientists particularly worried that the hot water was killing a lot of life on the rocks. Oceanic Administration biologist Jerry Galt was involved in the debate about when to stop.
I think from an environmental point of view, I would say if you're concerned only with the environment, that trade-off comes pretty early, because the oil, once it starts to stiffen up and become basically immobile, then it's not much of an environmental threat. It's not going to go offshore, for example, and kill otters, and it's not going to get birds, and it's not going to get into the ecosystem very much. And so at that point, I think it's probably better to leave it alone. We find out, though, that there's a lot of damage caused by a spill. Tends to be in a wide range, some of it not just ecological, some of it perceptional, really.
And part of that perception involved Alaska's prized salmon fishery. State officials not only wanted to preserve the fish, but just as important, the reputation of the fish as a delectable commodity. Again, biologist Jerry Galt.
we work on oil spills all the time, and we've never seen a major fin fishery damaged by an oil spill per se. We have seen over and over and over again them damaged by the perception that there's damage.
And Galt's colleague, Sharon Christofferson, says that even if some of the cleanup was best left to nature, Exxon would have had a hard time suggesting that.
The oil was on the shoreline. Politically, do you think there's any way that Exxon could have not cleaned it?
So scientists pushed on, looking for new techniques and new technologies that could help remove more of the oil. Environmental Protection Agency Research Chief Eric Bretthauer says one major experimental program involves speeding up nature's own cleanup processes.
Well, a technique simply involves adding fertilizer, as you and I would buy for our lawns or gardens, to the bacteria that are on the beach, the naturally occurring bacteria. And these fertilizers cause the bacteria to multiply, as they would in any setting, and certain of these bacteria are known to degrade oil.
Government scientists started to experiment with this technique in June. They tried it on a few beaches that Exxon had already hosed off, and Bretthauer says the treated rocks really did look cleaner after a few weeks.
It appeared so successful, certainly to visual examination, that we thought the technology was at a point that we could consider a wider scale use in Prince William Sound.
So in the waning weeks of the summer, scientists set about fertilizing more rocky beaches. They treated 70 miles of coast, about 7% of the area that had been washed down. Unfortunately, the bacteria are likely to slow down when the weather gets cold, the way everything does in Alaska, and come springtime, the remaining oil will have turned into a substance that looks like asphalt, and bacteria are likely to have a hard time digesting that. So scientists like Jay Hare from the National Wildlife Federation don't expect too much from the bacteria.
Even if they work perfectly, they're only a surface solution because those particular bacteria are aerobic. They require oxygen. They cannot go down into the gravel and do their job.
And oil has soaked several feet into the gravel in places around Prince William Sound. The most frustrating to government biologist Sharon Christofferson is how little oil spill research has advanced since 1978. That was the year the Amoco Cadiz ran aground off France and spilled 68 million gallons of crude.
The technology seems to have to be recreated every time we have a major spill. The last really huge spill like this was the Amoco Cadiz, and that stimulated some research that was looked at for a while, but when there wasn't another large oil spill that came along, it kind of died out. Now we have another large oil spill, and a lot of our time was spent kind of recreating or redeveloping existing techniques to work in this environment.
Congress is now considering a new $25 million program to test new oil cleanup techniques. And while experts welcome that, they also expect that large spills like the Exxon Valdez will inevitably do a lot of environmental damage, and Mother Nature will end up doing most of the cleanup herself. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
Cleanup of the nation's worst oil spill officially ended on Friday when Exxon laid off the last of its Alaskan work crews and prepared for a scaled-down winter operation. The oil that spewed from the grounded tanker Exxon Valdez last March eventually spread along more than 1,000 miles of Alaskan coastline. The cleanup that followed mobilized thousands of workers, ranging from volunteers who rescued otters and birds to crews that assaulted the oiled beaches with hot water and chemicals. How much was accomplished and how much remains to be done are still matters of dispute among Exxon, the U.S. Coast Guard, environmentalists, and the state of Alaska. All those parties got a chance to speak their minds yesterday during a nationwide call-in show. From Anchorage, Corey Flintoff reports.
Exxon maintains that worker safety considerations have forced them to suspend work on the beaches for the winter. Bad weather has sometimes made even the summer work difficult. And since Exxon began its cleanup in March, the company has gradually changed its goals. At first, Exxon officials talked of restoring the environment to its pristine condition, then of cleaning it. Eventually, the goal word became treatment. The beaches would be treated, a process that critics say could involve little more than picking up oily refuse and leaving the gross contamination untouched. Finally, the phrase became environmentally stable. An Exxon cleanup manager, Otto Harrison, told a caller yesterday that that major goal has been reached.
I believe that we have these beaches to the point that they're not going to interfere with otters and seals and birds. That was an objective from the start. I think that we have substantially achieved that objective. We still have more to do. We're not quitting. We're still here. We have an extremely active program. We have one of the world's most intensive science programs going on this winter. And we're going to be working with you and with everyone else to get the best understanding possible of this situation.
Coast Guard Admiral Paul Yost took issue with Exxon's claim that all the beaches are now safe for wildlife. Speaking from the Coast Guard cutter Sweetbriar in Prince William Sound, the president's top official on the spill said Exxon underestimated the work required by somewhere around 20%.
They had a plan that would have had them finish the cleanup sometime in mid-August. And here we are in mid-September, and we're scrambling, or we're scrambling in the last few days, to clean, to treat the last few miles of beach. And as a matter of fact, those last few miles, although they were treated, were not fully treated. And the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, in permitting a demobilization, noted that those beaches were not treated to the extent that they should have been and that the other beaches had been. What we have is an absolutely superb effort that, frankly, fell short. And for that reason, we will require them to come back in the spring and do what needs to be done.
Not everyone shared the Admiral's confidence in Exxon's willingness to finish the job or in the Coast Guard's ability to enforce it. A caller from St. Louis directed this comment at Alaska Senator Ted Stevens.
Hello, my name is Tina Brown, and I worked in Alaska as a volunteer this summer in Seward cleaning sea otters. And I'm concerned about the system that operated in this cleanup. When I sat in these meetings in July, I saw the Coast Guard support and sympathize with Exxon when state agencies were trying to demand appropriate cleanup activity. And I don't think the kind of attention is focused on Exxon's attitude and the ability that it has to determine whether or not it will continue.
Well, I'm pleased you're up here to help us. We believe that we should change the law. We will change the law so that there is authority for the president to be in charge. But basically, we're also trying to make certain we try to get the oil out of the water so it won't ever get to the beaches and harm the otters that you saw. You know, Exxon is committed to come back. They've already told the Senate that, and Senate Commerce Committee and the Congress, that they will come back if the Coast Guard believes there's work to be done. And you've heard Admiral Yost. He says it's not done yet. So Exxon will be back.
Some callers demanded to know why the federal government hadn't simply taken over the cleanup rather than letting Exxon do it with Coast Guard oversight. Speaking from Washington, the Wilderness Society's George Frampton agreed that the federal government probably should have used its takeover authority, but argued that that really wasn't the point.
The local communities, the state, and the federal government could have handled this in all likelihood much better than Exxon. I think, though, that the federal government was afraid that the money wouldn't be there. And that's why we need legislation. The fact is that federal takeover of cleanup is not the solution to this problem. Mm-hmm. As long as we don't have the incentives for the companies themselves to change their ways and make the necessary investments, federal involvement is not going to be a guarantee that this kind of thing won't continue to happen over and over again.
Liability for spillers and authority for cleanup are among the major focuses of oil spill legislation that will be debated in Congress over the coming months. Some actual cleanup work will continue, on a small scale at least, as part of the state of Alaska's winter oil spill program. Both Exxon and the state will be monitoring the situation and conducting research on new cleanup methods for use in the spring. For National Public Radio, I'm Corey Flintoff in Anchorage.
Imagine getting a check every year from your state for just living there. In Alaska, a 500,000 residents annually receive hundreds of dollars from the state savings account. KTOO reporter Claire Richardson says that this year's check is the highest since the program began in 1982.
Royalties from Alaska's North Slope oil fields have lined the state treasury with almost $9.5 billion. Several years ago, the 49th state's legislature agreed to give half of the annual interest from that Alaska Permanent Fund to the people. This year, the dividend check is $873.16, and most Alaskans know exactly where the money will be going.
College funds for my kids.
Gonna put it in the bank.
A trip to Hawaii.
I'm probably gonna put it in a savings account. I know that's really boring, but I'm into saving these days.
I put up new gutters this summer. It's already been spent.
Irvin Jones is the director of Alaska's Permanent Fund Dividend. He says more than $2 billion have been given directly to residents in the last 7 years. And with the memory of the Exxon Valdez oil spill still fresh in the nation's mind, he bristles at the thought that some people consider it a payoff by the oil companies.
That absolutely is not the case. First of all, the permanent fund was established by the people of Alaska back in 1976. But the oil companies didn't care what the state of Alaska did with the money, except to the extent that many of them are Alaskan residents. And many of them undoubtedly voted, I'm talking executives and employees of the oil companies, undoubtedly voted in the 1976 election as well as the rest of us.
But some Alaskans refused to accept the permanent fund. Attorney Mary Nordell, who served as Alaska's Commissioner of Revenue from 1984 to 86, says the money should be spent on improving government services.
We have urgent needs, I think, in education, especially at the university level. Transportation, our transportation systems are abysmally inadequate for the development of the state. We need to do better by way of social services, protection of children, battered adults. We need an improved court system. We need a lot of services which our general fund revenues are inadequate to fund at this time.
523,000 Alaskans applied for the 1989 permanent fund dividend check. For National Public Radio, I'm Claire Richardson in Juneau, Alaska.
The president of the Exxon Corporation has told the people of Alaska that they must find a balance between the risks and benefits of the oil industry on which many of them depend. Last night in Anchorage, in a speech that was disrupted by protesters, William Stevens says his company has done the best it can to handle environmental problems created by the spill in Prince William Sound. More from Steve Heimel.
William Stevens has been to the spill sites 5 times, but this was his first appearance to make a speech. In a forum hosted by 2 chambers of commerce, he had a largely sympathetic audience, but not entirely. As he talked about the company's safety record, he was interrupted by protesters.
What happened in Prince William Sound was, and yes, still is, like a bad dream. But we recognize the reality. We've had to accept and handle the problem as best we could, as have too, I realize, many Alaskans.
We don't want to hear any more of your
recognizing this fact.
Stevens was unruffled by the interruptions. He said he understood the anger, that it had been felt in Alaska by all Exxon employees.
And, you know, it's the very least that I can do as president of Exxon Company USA. Come forward and, if you will, face people who do truly have a high degree of upset with us.
The Exxon president said some company policies are undergoing reevaluation in the wake of the spill. They'll seek to reduce risks and work on their alcohol and substance abuse policy. But he would not blame the tanker grounding itself on alcohol. Instead, he called it an example of what chance can do and warned against overreaction.
Should we let chance events, which could happen, prevent us from taking risk? The fact is that a measure of risk is inherent in all progress.
Stevens is clearly concerned about a change in Alaska's attitude toward big oil. With Congress still undecided about drilling in what could be America's last giant oil field in the Arctic, opposition from Alaska itself could be pivotal in the debate. There is still considerable anger in Alaska, especially in communities in the path of the spill. They're not likely to be satisfied by what Stevens told them.
When spring comes, it's going to be time for a new look at the shorelines and to make judgments on what can be done, which will be a net benefit. If based on that review, the federal on-scene coordinator requests that Exxon undertake additional reasonable work, we'll do so.
Net benefit is the code word for cleanup activities that will not do more harm than good. There's likely to be considerable debate about that next spring. Alaska Environmental Conservation Commissioner Denny Kelso says the state wants a winter of research into new cleanup technologies.
We think that this winter is an excellent time to take stock of the methods that have been used and to do the research and development so that we have a much more effective set of methods ready to go next spring.
Kelso says what Exxon calls a bad dream is still going on for communities in the path of the spill. Just last week, some loose oil was seen drifting near one of them. For National Public Radio in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
For a third time this year, an oil tanker has been caught in Cook Inlet waters off Alaska without a contingency plan in case of an oil spill. The ship has been refused docking permission in Cook Inlet. Peter Kenyon of Alaska Public Radio has more on what appears to be a tightening of requirements for oil tankers in Alaska waters.
The Union Oil of California tanker Sansanina II was bound for a refinery carrying 14.7 million gallons of oil when Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation denied permission for the tanker to operate in Cook Inlet. The Sansanina will not be allowed to dock until it has an approved oil spill contingency plan. Under state law, tankers are required to submit plans explaining what equipment they have, where it's located, and how it would be used to deal with an oil spill. Unocal hastily submitted a spill plan Wednesday, but it will be at least several days before the state can review it. Unocal could get temporary coverage under another company's plan, or the state may authorize an emergency unloading simply to get the oil out of Cook Inlet's often stormy fall weather. DEC says other vessels may be operating without spill plans, and more enforcement actions may be coming. Tankers operating in nearby Prince William Sound are facing a November 13th deadline to file spill plans or lose docking privileges at the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Terminal at Valdez. DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso says he issued that order because he was shocked by the decision to hand cleanup of the nation's worst oil spill over to Exxon, which had no cleanup plan tailored to Alaskan conditions. The pipeline is run by an oil company consortium known as the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. Spokesperson George Jerkowicz said the company was baffled by the order. He said Alyeska's policy has always been to hand over cleanup to the spiller, and the state knew that long before the Exxon Valdez spill.
Last year, there was an exercise conducted in which Alyeska and ARCO and others participated, including the DEC, in which we rehearsed the transition of responsibility from Alyeska to an owner.
Kelso insists that his first hint that Alyeska intended to hand off to Exxon was when it happened in March, and he says that violates state law. For National Public Radio in Juneau, Alaska, I'm Peter Kenyon.